The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On this edition of Century, psilocybin in the Garden State. A measure to set up a psilocybin-assisted psychotherapy pilot program was recently approved by a New Jersey legislative committee with a do-pass recommendation, in spite of opposition from several policy reform activists and psychedelic therapy advocates. We'll hear more about New Jersey Assembly Bill A3852 later in the show. But first, the World Health Organization, the International Network on Health and Hepatitis and Substance Users, and Médecins du Monde held a webinar recently to launch a new WHO technical document entitled WHO Guidance on Maintaining Opioid Agonist Maintenance Treatment as an Essential Health Service. Let's first get an overview from Anya Busse, head of the Drugs, Alcohol, and Addictive Behaviors Unit at WHO.
WHO recommends really a comprehensive approach to opioid dependence treatment. This includes, first and foremost, opioid agonist maintenance therapy, which we will call here OAMT, with methadone or buprenorphine. Opioid antagonists like naltrexone after withdrawal can also be considered, and psychosocial support. Naloxone needs to be available for emergency management of opioid overdose. WHO recommends, and I think that is important here, that OAMT should be used for most patients with opioid dependence, as it is the interventions for which there is the strongest evidence of effectiveness for a broad range of health and social outcomes, such as, for example, it can lower overdose risk, prevent HIV and hepatitis transmission, increase treatment adherence, reduce criminal justice contacts, and improve quality of life. Methadone and buprenorphine, as mentioned, the key medications here are life-saving medicines that are on the WHO essential medicines list. And as has been said, these are also essential health services and part of the universal health coverage packages. So in a longer term perspective, opioid agonist maintenance treatment really should be considered as a long-term solution for opioid dependence treatment. WHO emphasizes that treatment should be open-ended and continue as long as clinically indicated. Policies thus should allow for flexible dosing, starting low, maintaining higher dosage without limits on dose or duration. And those adjustments are gradual, and gradual reductions are possible, but the strength of OAMT really lies in its sustained and individualized and continued approach. Therefore, any dose reductions should be patient-driven, clinically guided, and need to ensure safety and effectiveness. So in cases of involuntary interruptions of OAMT, those first and foremost really need to be avoided at all case. Because given the biopsychosocial nature of opioid dependence that often takes the course of a chronic health condition, patients with interruptions then might return to use. Involuntary or unplanned service interruptions, we need to take this into account, can be life-threatening. They can lead to withdrawal, to relapse, to overdose, and increase risks of HIV, hepatitis, and other health and social harms, and therefore must be avoided. So OMT services really must plan to be resilient, including in times of crisis, which includes stock management and the preparation of a well-trained workforce. And I think we will hear some examples during the webinar. So also during crisis, uninterrupted OMT must be ensured. Essential medicines such as methadone or buprenorphine should never be disrupted, and flexibilities in the import and export of controlled medicines such as these two should be used and explored. If interruptions are expected, again, contingency measures need to be implemented as early as possible to minimize potential negative consequences. Access to healthcare is a fundamental human right, and this includes people with opioid dependence wherever they are, in the community or in prison settings. OAMT should be prioritized like any other life-saving health service. Health system disruptions, such as those for which kind of we have addressed and written the guidance, might include funding cuts, policy changes, emergencies, the COVID-19 pandemic comes to mind, and those can affect disproportionately vulnerable populations. So resilience is possible, and as said, adaptive strategies can be put in place. So if there are interruptions, for example, if NGOs have been providing OMT before and through funding shortages cannot continue, there is a possibility to move that over to public health facilities, primary care providers, pharmacy, or even private clinics. And budget allocations are important, and ideally we really want to see OMT integrated in national health budgets. People who use drugs have shown remarkable resilience during crises like armed conflicts or the COVID-19 pandemic. And to manage potential disruptions in OMT, it's therefore vital to involve affected populations and provide clear and timely information to prevent further distress. Peer workers can support patients at treatment sites, while strong communication channels can enable rapid responses and overdose prevention actions. Training and harm reduction counseling, such as, for example, avoiding high-risk injecting behaviors, such as using a loom, are essential in this case. And a coordinated approach is overall needed among different stakeholders that include health, but also law enforcement and other key actors that might face a crisis with large groups experience withdrawal symptoms in case of OMT interruptions. So among the mitigation measures that are discussed and recommended in the document is that when there are workforce shortages but medication remain available, that expanding well-structured take-home doses for methadone or buprenorphine can be further considered, especially for stable patients and when there is a low risk of diversion. Take-home schemes have really proven effective during emergencies like COVID-19, when care was limited due to the social contact restrictions. So that's one of the recommendations to really increase considerations for take-home. Another consideration in times of crisis and OMT shortages is to consider and have good opioid overdose emergency programs in place. In this case, naloxone is recommended. It's an emergency medication that can reverse an overdose when given in time, an opioid overdose. And WHO recommends that people likely to witness an opioid overdose should have access to naloxone and be instructed in its administration. Naloxone is available in different formulations. Often the intramuscular injectable naloxone is cheaper, but it requires often additional training and laws to be in place to facilitate that. And good Samaritan laws are considered here in special that recognize that the risk of withholding naloxone is higher than the concern about allowing lay people to administer naloxone in case of an emergency. So naloxone is really a life-saving medication that needs to be available, especially during the times of crisis we are talking about here. Assisted withdrawal management is, in general, let's say, less recommended, because most people should be advised to continue opioid agonist maintenance treatment as possible, right? And the relapse will be lower. It's overall, we discussed the benefits. But when forced and abrupt opioid withdrawal occurs, including due to shortages of medications, and withdrawal is unavoidable, then it must withdrawal management must follow well-established protocols for pharmacological management of opioid withdrawal with psychosocial support that includes tapering doses. Also, methadone and buprenorphine can be used in withdrawal management, as well as other medications such as alpha-2 agonists, clonidine or lofexidine. And for patients that have completed withdrawal and might be motivated to really stop using opioids overall, there is also the possibility for naltrexone for relapse prevention. But keep in mind, this webinar is really on saying that most people should be advised to continue on OMT as possible. So coming already to a closing of this, I also would like to highlight that psychosocial support and a variety of psychosocial interventions should be available according in times of crisis to support patients. Those can include counseling, evidence-based psychotherapy, but also assistance with social needs such as housing, employment, education, welfare, or legal problems. So, and in general, we have also seen that withdrawal protocols are more effective if psychosocial assistance is offered. So that might suggest that also in cases of unintended OMT interruptions, psychosocial support really can play a role. Peer support, crisis management, all of this can help in addition to mitigate the stress linked with the crisis of not having access to life-saving medications. So here are again the key messages from the publication that we are very happy to launch with you today. WHO recommends opioid agonist maintenance treatment as the intervention to be offered to most patients with opioid dependence, and it must be maintained without interruption also during crisis as an essential health service. OMT should be fully integrated into national health systems and not treated as an optional. If disruptions occur, early contingency measures are critical, and we discussed those. Communities have to be consulted. Naloxone access has to be expanded. There can be reinforcing take-home dosages of methadone, buprenorphine, increasing psychosocial support, and the multi-stakeholder coordination. Abrupt dose reductions can be life-threatening. That's the other really take-home message here. And if withdrawal is unavoidable, it needs to be following established medical protocols. So with this, I just want to let you know that we are currently also updating the WHO guidelines on psychosocially assisted pharmacological opioid dependence treatment and the guidelines on community management of opioid overdose, and are merging those. And I think the first recommendations will be available by the middle of next year.
That was Anja Busse, head of the Drugs, Alcohol, and Addictive Behaviors Unit at the World Health Organization, speaking at an event to launch a new WHO technical document entitled WHO Guidance on Maintaining Opioid Agonist Maintenance Treatment as an Essential Health Service. Ms. Busse gave an overview of the guidance. Now let's hear another speaker from that launch, Anton Basenko, Executive Director of the International Network of People Who Use Drugs.
Today my presentation is based on the data from our recent multi-language survey conducted in March earlier this year, which was launched also on the CND. This survey conducted during an acute crisis period following major U.S. funding cuts. You all remember what happened. And it reflects the lived realities of people and organizations on the ground, not projections, not models, but immediate human impact, which we evaluated. So on this slide, let me begin with who this data represents. So we received 101 responses from across regions, acknowledging gaps in country coverage, but with strong representation from frontline actors. So 65% of respondents were drug user-led organizations, networks of people who use drugs. Another 22% were local civil society organizations providing harm reduction services, including OET, case management or support. And 13% were international NGOs or drug policy NGOs or even government partners. The matters, because drug user-led organizations are often the first to see service disruptions and the last to be consulted when funding decisions are made. So the survey was conducted during this emergency moment, and what it shows is not a theoretical risk, but early warning signals of systemic collapse. So what are our four key takeaways from that survey? U.S. funding cuts have cut harm reduction service at the knees. You can look at this table and compare top 10 services respondents implementing as organizations or have been implementing at the moment of that survey. And then the next, you can see the top 10 service disruptions. So what services have been affected as a result of this funding cuts or receive stop orders or other terminations. So evidence-based harm reduction models, including OET, are dismantled rapidly. And of course, you can see OET in this list, especially in low and middle-income countries. Without these services, sustaining HIV and hepatitis C responses becomes increasingly unrealistic. And also, taking into account the general influence of progressive drug policies like harm reduction services on the lives of people who use drugs and their environment. Second, the impact has human face. And this is not about abstract budget lines. It is about people forced off treatment, peer workers losing jobs, clinics reducing hours, and communities facing rising overdose risk. Third, without peer-driven harm reduction services, the entire infrastructure of harm reduction is placed in jeopardy, and peer outreach is not an add-on. It is foundational to access, retention, and trust. And if you can see that the number one is outreach and peer-led harm reduction services, which has been disrupted, then those of us who are working in the field, we know that this is a basic element for the entire harm reduction model. Once you remove outreach and peer-led approach or peer-led, peer-led approach, you cannot really implement the harm reduction model in its full. And finally, the fourth, these disruptions are happening at the exact moment when global commitments say put people first, but as the data shows, people who use drugs are being excluded from that promise. The data is clear, OET is being disrupted. Let me be very clear about what the data tells us. 63% of organizations report severe financial impact due to US funding withdrawal. Almost half lost 26 to 100% of their total budget. 23% lost between 75% to 100% of all their funding. And critically for today's discussion, 25% report reduced access to opioid agonist therapy. 43% report disruptions to needle and syringe programs. Disruption naloxone distribution, observed increased overdose death. And for women who use drugs, the impact is even more severe. 68% of services for women were reduced or halted. Peer-led outreach, which is essential for linking people to OET and keeping them in care, was also among the most disrupted services, as I mentioned earlier. And this is not accidental. Peer services are often the least protected in funding structures, despite being among the most effective. What OET disruptions look like in practice? Of course, when we talk about OET disruptions, we're not talking about minor inconvenience. It's also medication interruptions and reduced clinic hours, loss of trained staff and peer workers, increased risk of treatment discontinuation, heightened risk of overdose, HIV and hepatitis risk. And these disruptions do not happen in isolation. They interact with other stressors. For instance, emergency context. I'm from Ukraine. My country is fourth year in the war. We do remember how much we were struggling in the first stage of the war from the disruptions or risk of disruptions when Russians attacked my country and occupied certain regions or destroyed healthcare facilities, which provide OET. But it's I'm proud to say that we not just survived, we stand strong, and we even increased number of OET patients in the country over the years of the war. But emergency context can be also natural disaster. Political factors, changes of the drug policy. Unfortunately, our friendly country, Georgia, which was one of the also pioneers and good examples of OET development in the region of Eastern Europe, Central Asia. Unfortunately, due to the latest changes in the, let's say, service delivery or drug policy approach, when all OET programs based on the private clinics has been closed and the patients were proposed to go to the public healthcare facilities, but not all patients want or are able to do it. And there was, of course, some reason why they were using private clinics. So Among the others, procurement system reforms, transition of the source of funding, countries from in the Global Fund transition know this very well. Quality of drugs, recent case in Egypt also telling us that this can be a reason for disruption for certain patients.
You
I
have
mean,
one
disruption.
Minute, Anton.
Oh, okay. I'm actually I'm on my last slide. So disruptions are not failures, not inevitable crisis. And let me be clear, these OET disruptions are not inevitable. They are a result of all these reasons which you saw. But what needs to happen? Our call to action, inputs call to action is grounded on evidence, WHO guidance, which you just see, and lived experience. So first, for donors, funding agencies, emergency pooled funding mechanism must be established to prevent the collapse of harm reduction services, including OAT. And this is not about innovation, it is about stabilization. Second, for governments and policymakers, national governments must step in to sustain services previously reliant on US funding, and this includes protecting OET as essential health service, implementing social contracting models that prioritize community-led providers, removing legal and administrative barriers that delay OET procurement and delivery. And of course, innovations and long-acting forms of OET are very welcome and important, but only if those medications are not used as a repression or punishment measure. Third, for UN agencies and international bodies, emergency resource allocation must prioritize people who use drugs. And finally, for drug user-led networks and civil society, we must intensify advocacy, build alliances, and speak with one voice. So please use our report. QR code is on your screen. Input is planning to have a next cycle of this survey very soon to see the changes and reality of reduced funding for community as of now. And let me end where I began. OET is not option. It is not experimental. It is not luxury. It is essential medicine recognized by WHO, proven by decades of evidence, and relied upon by millions of people worldwide. When OET is disrupted, people die. When peer services are cut, people disappear from care. And when funding decisions ignore this reality, the cost is paid in human lives. If we're serious about ending AIDS, preventing overdose, upholding the right to health, then protecting OET continuity is non-negotiable. Input stands ready to work with all partners to make that happen, but the time for action is now. Thank you.
That was Anton Basenko, Executive Director of the International Network of People Who Use Drugs, speaking at an event to launch a new WHO technical document entitled WHO Guidance on Maintaining Opioid Agonist Maintenance Treatment as an Essential Health Service. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Turning now to the glorious Garden State of New Jersey, that state's legislature is considering a measure that, according to the official synopsis, establishes psilocybin behavioral health access and therapy pilot program, appropriates $6 million. Assembly Bill A-3852, an act concerning a pilot program for psilocybin research and making an appropriation, was considered by the Assembly Appropriations Committee on Thursday, December 18th. Let's hear some of that testimony. Here's Neil Usatan with New Jersey for Fungi and Plant Medicine.
My name is Neil Usatan. Good morning, esteemed members of the Appropriations Committee. Thank you for considering A353852 this morning. I come to this work from my experience working on a Netflix documentary called How to Change Your Mind, and seeing firsthand the benefits of psychedelic-assisted therapy. I began advocating for this bill in its earlier iterations in 2023, and I've since earned an MBA and formed a coalition called New Jersey for Fungi and Plant Medicines, comprised of medical doctors, nurses, therapists, social workers, academics, lawyers, farmers, business leaders, and most importantly, folks who stand to benefit from this medicine. In one respect, this bill seems like you should pass it. The clinical evidence in FDA trials is clear that psilocybin is not only safe and non-habit forming, it treats depression, anxiety, OCD, addiction, and a number of other health indications more effectively than current therapies. The FDA has also designated psilocybin a breakthrough therapy, and currently the U.S. Senate has a bipartisan bill championed by our own Senator Booker that would create a legal pathway for patients with serious and life-threatening conditions to access certain psychedelic therapies under medical supervision. not unlike the proposed pilot program in A3852. Despite this progress on the federal level and the promise this bill represents toward overcoming the stigma and realizing the potential of psychedelic medicines, this bill is too incomplete to pass. It needs more work. The pilot program in this bill to study medical access to FDA-compliant psilocybin leaves too much room for interpretation as to how the pilot program will be set up, who will design the pilot program, and who will benefit. This bill appropriates taxpayer funds to source likely synthetic psilocybin manufactured by pharmaceutical companies in phase two or three trials seeking approval from the FDA for their product. That creates conditions for elite capture with data handed to the advisory board that is no different than the extensive data that exists in clinical trials already demonstrating the efficacy I described earlier. Earlier iterations of this bill created a New Jersey supply chain with natural psilocybin mushrooms grown by New Jersey farmers. Botanical drug manufacturers already have the technology to extract the full spectrum medically beneficial compounds from the mushroom and create a GMP level purity of 99.6% that would be the FDA and that would be FDA compliant. This could be sourced in the state and begin to build a local supply chain which would provide more information to the advisory board in its decision as to whether to expand the pilot program. This bill is also too myopic, focusing on behavioral health, and needs to include physical health conditions like chronic pain, such as cluster headaches, which some of our members in the coalition suffer from, described as a hot ice pick stabbed in the eye, sitting there for 30 to 90 minutes. Cluster headache patients, through citizen science, found the solution to their own medical issue, discovering that natural psilocybin mushrooms help regulate their headaches, control the pain, and keep them at bay. Those suffering from cluster headache deserve access to natural psilocybin mushrooms to regulate their condition, which can be regulated by the state, eventually in a parallel marketplace. So again, this bill reads like a great step forward in an effort to legalize psilocybin-assisted therapy in the state of New Jersey. However, I encourage this committee not to pass this bill in its current form, or in the very least demand subsequent revisions that include naturally sourced FDA compliant GMP quality psilocybin for mental health and chronic pain. Thank you.
That was Neil Usatan with New Jersey for Fungi and Plant Medicine testifying December 18th in opposition to Assembly Bill A3852, an act concerning a pilot program for psilocybin research and making an appropriation. That measure was approved by the Assembly Appropriations Committee on a vote of 7-4. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's AudioPort service. Please support public media and local community radio. Become members. Become volunteers. Find this edition of Century, along with an archive of past shows, at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.